This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we first hear from a professor of education on how the growing banning of books, censorship of teachers, and clampdown on student protest works to the benefit of those who would lead our nation into fascism.
We speak with Professor Henry Giroux, one of the great educators in North America, about his hopefulness in the student movement finding allies throughout the broader society. We also speak with Norman Solomon, who's just reissued his great book, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine.
His new afterword to the book focuses on the corporate media's biased coverage of the Israeli-U.S. war in Gaza.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist, and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Fascist Germany's industrial murder of Jews in Europe 80 years ago has been seared into the consciousness of humankind. Today, it's a great irony of history that the Israeli government, which claims to be the moral legatee of the Holocaust, is carrying out a genocide against millions of Palestinians in Gaza. This is being done with the full support of the American government, which supplies political, diplomatic, and propaganda cover for what Israel is doing. It supplies the bombs, planes, artillery shells, tanks, and bulldozers to physically destroy the buildings and infrastructure of the Gaza Strip. The people who live there have been systematically starved as the Nazis starved the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto. The response of American students in college campuses across the country was magnificent. Tent encampments sprung up in several hundred places. They became the focal point for a full-throated discussion of the realities in Gaza and American complicity in the ongoing genocide. Demands for ceasefire were raised, demands that the universities divest themselves of investments in Israel and American arms manufacturers were put forward. Sadly, this manifestation of critical thinking came to a crashing end. The wealthy and their servants in Congress and in the mass media accused the students of being anti-Semitic and of supporting terrorism. Congressional hearings were held. University presidents were fired. Professors lost their jobs. Students were expelled from schools. The great campus uprising was closed down. To talk to us today about education, fascism, and democracy is Professor Henry Giroux. He currently holds the McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest in the English and Cultural Studies Department of McMaster College in Canada, and is the Pablo Freire Distinguished Scholar in Creative Pedagogy. Henry Giroux has authored many books, most recently with Anthony DiMaggio, titled Fascism on Trial, Education and the Possibility of Democracy. Professor Henry Giroux, a hearty welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Henry, with the suppression of the Palestine Solidarity Movement on campuses, is it fair to say that the campuses have been turned into the American Homeland Security campuses?
I think it's fair to say that. I mean, I think in many ways what we're seeing, particularly in light of the protests against Israel and its slaughter of the Palestinian people, is we're seeing that the question of free speech is now being responded to, not by dialogue or an attempt to sort of understand the issues or to give students an opportunity to narrate themselves, but students are now met with snipers, checkpoints, violent police crackdowns. And in many ways, I mean, what we're seeing is militarized policing as a response to dissent. I mean, my argument is that what's happening on campuses in the United States, and in some cases, a number of other countries, is that the role of education as a democratic public sphere is being challenged in ways unlike we've ever seen before. I mean, all of a sudden, we have billionaires who are basically supporting repressive policies. And we have the military basically being called in, the police, to suppress dissent. Students are being beaten. Faculty are being arrested. I've never seen anything like this since the 1960s. And I think it's fair to say that, as Michael Gold-Watofsky has argued, that what we now have is the American Homeland Security campus. that the notion of oppression is not just simply around censorship. It's basically about the beating of bodies and the arresting of protesters and the reliance upon the military, the reliance upon the police to turn the campus into a police precinct. So it's pretty hard not to assume that something radical has changed with respect to questions of academic freedom and dissent, particularly when the dissenters, the protesters, have really expanded the nature of their own critiques. They're not just against the war in Gaza and of course, increasingly in Lebanon. They're against the university in some ways, suppressing free speech and investing in the war machine. That's dangerous.
Henry, let's talk about public education overall in the country today, if we can. Public education, it seems to me, and you've just been talking about one aspect of it, but at a broader level, it's under attack in the form of banned books, erased history, if certain parts of our history are even reported on in the textbooks anymore, the form of banned books, erased history, as I say, and the suppression of dissent, as you've already pointed out. You've written that education is never really neutral anyway. It's always a political act. And you wrote that it either serves to, well, liberate or domesticate, to either empower or to subjugate. Talk to us about that.
I mean, I think it's very clear that education is always political. There's no such thing as neutral education. Educate, you know, power is never not related to education in the form of the way the curriculum is produced, the way funds are allocated, the way the public and higher education function as sorting machines. But I think the real issue here is that education is central to political struggle because it's a means of fostering particular forms of agency, self-reflection. It basically functions in a way to legitimate certain conceptions of the self, their relationship to other, history, and how we view the future. And so I think in that way, when you talk about, for instance, banned books, censoring history, the suppression of labor, indiscriminate attacks on civic culture, all of these things suggest that education is a tinderbox, meaning that it either can function critically, educate students in a fundamental way to be informed and to be critical thinkers and engage citizens. I think that what's really at stake here and what we have to understand, and it's crucial, is that you can't have a democracy without informed citizens. You can't have a democracy without institutions that nurture critical thought. And what we're seeing now, more than ever, in many ways, it's not just a form of McCarthyism. We're seeing an attack on any institution that in some way does two things, provides the economic conditions for these institutions to function, and in some way nurture their sense of critical inquiry. We're seeing that being eliminated. And we're seeing attacks on teachers. We're seeing attacks on educators who basically now are being fired if they somehow challenge the basic assumptions that drive a neoliberal, increasingly white Christian nationalist society.
Henry Giroux, please talk about your friendship with Pablo Freire, who he was, and why the two of you believed that democratizing education is the core of political resistance.
I mean, Paulo Freire was a Brazilian educator and a revolutionary of sorts. His seminal work was, of course, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which is really a kind of guide to understanding education as a tool for liberation, particularly in the face of forms of education that promoted particular types of illiteracy, denied people their history, didn't give them the skills to be able to read and write and think critically, prevent them from in some way examining what the conditions were that suppressed them. And of course, he organized a literacy campaign in the 1960s in Brazil, that was very empowering, and it gave people the opportunity to understand what it meant then to vote. In 1964, there was a military coup, and of course, Paulo was considered dangerous because, as one can say, like today, literacy is considered dangerous. The last thing that we want are people who basically can not only understand what democracy means, but basically can affirm its critical functions and enable it. Paulo and I became close friends in the 1980s, and we basically did everything we could to engage academics and young people and intellectuals in a way that would affirm the centrality of education to politics. We both believe that without a notion of critical education, you couldn't really take seriously what politics was about, because politics at its best, to say the very least, is about educating young people and others to understand the conditions under which they find themselves. And I think that in that sense, we had a books series for 15 years, publishing authors who basically could not get published in the mainstream press, and work together to basically inform and expand the concept of critical pedagogy, which in many ways has now become an international movement that's even more important in light of the ongoing suppression of public and higher education all over the world.
Let's talk now a bit about how we can get a handle on all of this. You say, for example, that we need to start by addressing certain concrete problems that people face. So tell us, first of all, what you see as these concrete problems, and then how do we then address them?
I think it's very clear we need to address the question of poverty. We need to address the question of a decent wage. We need to address what it means to people who have access to adequate and meaningful health care, free health care. We need to talk about free education. We need to talk about the meaningful jobs. We need to talk about what it means in some way to be able to create the conditions for people to challenge the rise of white Christian nationalism, an enormously deep-seated anti-intellectualism, and the erosion of civil rights. I mean, there are two arguments here. One is, what are the economic conditions that people absolutely have to have in order to have a life in which they don't have to make a choice between getting medicine and basically eating food or providing food for their children? And that means you need a meaningful wage, you need free health care, you need funds allocated for child care, you need a decent wage, a meaningful minimum wage. You need to in some way figure out how make power more equal. You need to democratize institutions in ways that, it would seem to me, would give people the opportunity to have opportunities that would enhance their ability to have a decent and meaningful life. On the other side, there's the ideological issue. And the ideological issue is, what do we do to expand the concept of democracy as a public good? What do we do to fight for democracy in ways that suggest there has to be a certain sense of the social contract? There has to be something that brings people together and connects them rather than divides them. What do we need to do educationally to attack the rise of systemic racism? But I think that for me, as an educator, one of the things that I find most crippling ideologically in light of this conversation is the notion that all problems are individual problems. We have no sense under neoliberalism of being able to translate private issues into larger systemic considerations. That's a massive form of depoliticization. It isolates problems, it blames people for the conditions under which they find themselves, and it normalizes enormous degrees of staggering inequality, the exploitation of the environment, a kind of rampant notion of self-interest, the demise of the social, the demise of the social state, and the rise of the punishing state. And so I think those two considerations have to be addressed. And these are very concrete issues, to say the least, because they bear down directly on how people live their lives, what their sense of individual and collective agency is, and how they understand themselves as being empowered to both address the conditions in which they find themselves and learn how to govern rather than be governed.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with Professor Henry Giroux. Henry, George Orwell understood that whoever controls education has the power to shape the future. The right in this country understands this profoundly, don't they? And they've taken concrete steps to gain control of the U.S. educational system, haven't they?
The right has always understood, not always, but since the 1970s, they've understood that the question of ideas and who controls the apparatuses that produces and legitimates those ideas. I mean, C. Wright Mills talked about the cultural apparatuses and what an important role they play in basically providing the theoretical political worldviews to which people understand themselves and operate. And I think that when you think back to the Powell memo of the 1970s, in which Powell said, hey, look, the right has to be engaged in the struggle for ideas. It needs to create, for the most part, think tanks. It needs to, in some way, be associated with universities. It needs to control the media. And I think all of that has happened. I mean, you know, five major corporations control 90% of all the media that's consumed in the United States. And I think that in some ways, their attack on public education, not just simply control over the social media with Google and all that, and X and all that sort of thing, which is another form of education, but they now are going after schools in ways, in public and higher education, in ways that we have never seen before. So I think they take the question of ideas seriously, not as a form of enlightenment, but basically as a form of suppression. They want to basically eliminate the possibility for a culture of thoughtfulness, informed citizens, critical thinking, an expansion of the imagination. They don't want to have anything to do with any of that stuff.
Well, and Henry, I mean, civics isn't taught anymore, for example, in the public schools. We could talk about that. But I want to ask you this. Why do you believe that the right wing's wish to whitewash history? To what extent is that really a precursor to fascism, if you will?
Well, I think that it seems to me that history can be dangerous because it can be enlightening. It can essentially reveal a whole range of injustices that need to be addressed if a democracy is going to fulfill itself. And I think that it is a precursor to fascism because by erasing the complexities of history and focusing, for instance, on racial purity and nationalism, it opens the door to authoritarian rule. It isn't a matter of just learning from history. It's a matter of understanding how history is always alive in the present. And that whoever controls that history in some way controls what it means to legitimate certain narratives over others, i.e., for instance, to control certain collective identities. When you erase the memories of Palestinian history, when you erase the memories concerning slavery and Jim Crow, when you erase how horrible capitalism has been over the last 50 years and destroying just about everything it touches, it normalizes the worst forms of domination. It makes people believe that they're inferior. It makes people believe they have no history, that history basically is only written by the victors, by those who have power. History is probably the most important pedagogical tool we have because historical consciousness doesn't just inform the present, it shapes the present. And it says something about the possibilities of the future not being the present.
Please talk about what you call a long-standing right-wing strategy to transform public and higher education into either corporate adjuncts or white Christian indoctrination centers.
I mean, look, there's been a particular transformation around schooling in the last 50 years, particularly since the late 1970s and the late 1980s. I mean, at one point, the issue was whether schools educate people to be democratic citizens or just workers. And that was the battle that went on for a long time. And the right basically did everything it could to turn education, particularly public education, into simply forms of training. I think that with 9/11 and the war on terror, the notion of education having a critical function came under attack in ways that we hadn't seen before. But I think what we see now is different. It's not just about suppressing education, critical forms of education. It's also about turning them into indoctrination centers, into centers to foster illiteracy, various forms of illiteracy, to foster white Christian nationalism, to foster a kind of highly extremist, corporatist mentality. It's a site that is now defined by three fundamentalisms: religious fundamentalism, economic fundamentalism, and political fundamentalism. So there's no attempt here in any way whatsoever to claim that education has to be defined through its claims on democracy, or that it should defend democracy, or that it should enable it. As a matter of fact, now the right defines education as something that has to be removed from democracy, and if anything, become a place where illiberal forms of democracy
can be practiced. And it's in ways that we see in Hungary. You shape a curriculum to eliminate anything about trans people. You eliminate critical thought. You fire professors who are critical. And you shape the curriculum per se in the way that DeSantis wants to shape it, as simply a vehicle for the worst forms of propaganda.
And I wonder then, Henry, if you could please tell us as well, and especially our audience wants to hear this, I think, who was Primo Levi? And talk about his observation that every age has its own fascism, and that we see the warning signs wherever the concentration of power denies a country's citizens the possibility and the means of expressing.
What was so profound about him was that he didn't freeze the experience of Nazism in a particular historical moment. He said that every age has its own fascism, and it arises when power is concentrated to deny citizens their freedom. And he felt that with the erosion of democratic rights, the suppression of dissent, and the concentration of power in relatively few hands, what you end up with eventually are the camps. What you end up with is, at first, you suppress dissent, you suppress ideas, you kill the institutions that make them possible, you eliminate them, and then you kill the intellectuals and the poets and the cultural workers and the dissenters who make them possible. He saw a direct line between the suppression of dissent and basically the camp. And his argument was those elements of that the elements of fascism take a different form in various societies, but the seeds are always there. And that you have to learn from history in order to recognize that.
Now, Henry Giroux, what does it mean to have a sense of hope in such dark times?
I think that, Michael, that's such a terrific question, because I think that without hope, there's no sense of agency. There's no sense of resistance. I think that when people can't imagine a future different from the present, there's no way to really understand that power is not just simply about domination, it's also about resistance. And that in every citadel and architecture of power, there are cracks. There are moments of resistance. There are possibilities. And without a sense of hope, you have no sense of agency. Without a sense of agency, you have no sense of hope. But I think that what we need to learn from this is that if you're going to have us, what the left and progressives need, they need to merge a sense of critique with a sense of possibility. And I want to make that concrete in that what I see happening today that around the question of criticism is that young people all over the globe are raising questions that basically expand and challenge issues that have become normalized for so long that they're now taken for granted. They no longer buy the assumption of common sense that capitalism is the only social order and social and economic order we can live in, that global capitalism can't be challenged, that justice doesn't matter, that protest is basically irrelevant in an age of mass suppression, that critical dissent doesn't have a place in a society that claims that there's no room for it. And I think that they're not only raising questions that basically have not been raised in the past or in the last 15 to 20 years, they're also working internationally with others across borders to basically try to understand how they can become a global force rather than just simply a national and limited social movement. Secondly, it seems to me that many of these social movements that operate off specific forms of oppression, whether we're talking about gender, the exploitation of women, the suppression of women's rights, or we're talking about the attack on civil rights around certainly black civil rights, or we're talking about poverty and those groups that are working to eliminate it and in some way address staggering forms of inequality, or climate activists, all of these groups increasingly realize they can't do this alone. They really have to connect with each other because these problems are connected. You can't talk about democracy and claim you're against the destruction of the planet around climate issues and be a racist. Democracy has a large expanse, a large umbrella. And it seems to me when we talk about political, economic, and social rights as being absolutely central to what it means to live in a radical democracy or a democratic socialist society, these movements have to come together and fight for that. And then at the same time, of course, do everything they can to make us understand the particular forms of oppression that they talk about.
Last year on the college campuses, we saw an amazing uprising of protest against what Israel with the armaments of the U.S. is doing in Gaza. We saw, as you pointed out earlier in this show, though, a draconian crackdown on that right to dissent by the administrators of these colleges. Since that time, the rules restricting protests on college campuses has grown even and more severe and more strict. Are you nevertheless hopeful, given what we've seen the students do around this issue, that come this, and we are now back to school, that we'll begin to see those kinds of protests again, not only on the college campuses, but throughout our society?
No, I am hopeful. I mean, I think that what has happened is that the protests have moved now to a somewhat different level. Now it's clear that the militarization of the university, it's turned to forms of academic suppression and the violation of free speech and the firing of faculty, has really reached a new level of intensity, and is being expanded. And I think that what these groups are now doing is they're mobilizing in ways to sort of link those issues so that they're not just talking about the struggle over Palestinian sovereignty, which is paramount. They're also talking about how these institutions are now under the control of billionaires and a form of gangster capitalism that has to be addressed, that these issues can't be separated. And I think what young people are doing now are mobilizing both, not only on the campus in the most spectacular ways, but mobilizing off the campuses and trying to join with labor unions and others to begin to produce a movement that will have very concrete effects. You know, the old saying by Mario Savio in the 1960s is you've got to stop the machine. The dock workers stopped the machine. And I think that young people are starting to learn from that. The auto workers stopped the machine. And I think that what we need is a mass collective movement in which we're in the streets and we stop these institutions from working. They've got to be stopped. They just can't go on being controlled by a ruling elite that is heartless and cruel. The Elon Musk of the world, I mean, they're part of a larger financial class. And what that's called is neoliberal capitalism on steroids. And when it begins to fail and it can't legitimate its own arguments, it turns to force. It turns to fascism. And that's what we're seeing now.
Henry Giroux, Jim Laffer and I are extremely grateful for your articulation of the situation that we're in. We totally support your viewpoint. We're very, very happy to have you on Law and Disorder. We thank you so much. Thank you. How can people get in touch with you and follow your work?
I have a website, first of all, at Henry A. Giroux, just one word, .com. And also people can get in touch with me by Gmail, henry.giroux@gmail.com. And also I'm on Twitter.
That's Giroux, G-I-R-O-U-X. Thanks, Henry. You take it easy. We'd like to have you back. Been great to talk to you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The United States is engaged in constant, if often invisible, wars. Or, if not invisible, at least not accurately and fully reported on in the corporate media, thereby leaving the people of the United States far from fully informed as to what and where U.S. military troops are stationed or engaged in military action. For example, while there has been a great deal of media coverage of the U.S.-supported Israeli war in Palestine, one would have needed to pay extra close attention to that coverage to know that the U.S., even before that war began, had 40,000 U.S. troops stationed in the area, or that the Biden administration has just recently sent at least 1,500 more to join them. And how many of us know that late last year, retired Israeli Major General Yitzhak Brick said that, and I quote, "All of our missiles, the ammunition, the precision-guided bombs, all the airplanes that bombs, it's all from the U.S. Everyone understands that we, Israel, can't fight this war without the United States, period." So last year, Norman Solomon, our guest today, wrote a much-noted and much-admired book titled War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. And that book has now been re-released with an updated afterword by the author all about the Gaza War and the press. Naomi Klein, best-selling author of The Shock Doctrine, says the book is a, and again I quote, a staggeringly important intervention. Noam Chomsky says Solomon's book is, quote, a gripping and painful study of the mechanisms behind our invisible but perpetual national state of war. Now, Norman Solomon is the co-founder of RootsAction.org and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and is, in fact, the author or co-author of at least 12 books, most touching on today's topic in either close or tangential ways. Well, Norman Solomon, a warm, warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much.
And Norman, today we're going to, well, focus on your contention that the U.S. media has not and is not reporting on the U.S.-Israeli war in Gaza in a way that could be called balanced or fair. In the new afterword to your book, you identify a half dozen ways in which this pro-Israeli bias shows itself. So let's talk about some of these indicators of the media bias. For example, you claim that the U.S. media failed to hold the U.S. accountable for its high-tech atrocities committed from the air, and second, that it has failed to hold the U.S. government accountable for the slaughter of civilians in Gaza. And Norman, you also make the point that studies have shown that the media refers to the deaths of Israelis in the conflict far more sympathetically than they do the deaths and in far, far greater numbers of the Palestinians. So talk to us about all of this.
We've really had a chronic pattern that has gone on throughout this century, where first after 9/11, the launch of the so-called War on Terror has been followed by now 23 years of U.S. media coverage where the victims of U.S. bombing have been abstractions, occasional feature stories, occasional numbers that are thrown into news accounts. But basically, when the U.S. has been killing civilians, that has been pretty much an inconsequential or very played-down aspect of media news reporting and commentary. Whereas, of course, the suffering, the deaths, the mourning, the losses of American soldiers from Iraq to Afghanistan have been pretty much exalted into the kind of empathetic coverage that should exist, which is to value all human lives, not just some human lives that are part of the United States military operation or among its allies. And unfortunately, that same pattern, the imbalance of media coverage, has really played out in terms of now, into its second year, the Israeli war in Gaza. And this isn't just anecdotal. We know from actual studies, for instance, by the media outlet The Intercept, the words used to describe the suffering of Israelis killed by Hamas on October 7th, 2023, have been very empathetic and very emotional. So let's take the word slaughter. The New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times used the word slaughter 60 different times to describe what Hamas had done to Israelis on October 7th. But those same media outlets used the word slaughter only once to describe what had been done in the first 6 weeks of the war on Gaza to the Palestinians. And that's just in the first month and a half of the war. This kind of imbalance really conveys to the public in the United States that some lives really matter and some lives really don't.
Norman, related to what you just discussed, you also make the claim that mainstream discourse has avoided reporting on those who have condemned the U.S. government for its role in the slaughter of civilians. Do you mean by that that voices from the movement against what Israel and the U.S. is doing in Gaza? Or do you mean that it's not reporting on voices from the U.S. government speaking out against the war? Please explain.
We've had very little coverage about the content of the movement against the U.S.-backed Israeli war on Gaza. A lot of discussion, especially in the spring, of the campus movements, the demonstrations, the encampments, where thousands and thousands of students were active to demand an end to the U.S. government's support of the slaughter in Gaza. And so the quantity of coverage of protests was certainly very big. The quality of it was a whole other matter. Very rarely did we actually hear from the protesters directly. They were talked about, they weren't heard from. And a lot of the coverage that did exist of their activities, and more broadly, protests around the country about the war on Gaza, the media coverage was often defamatory. It was negative. It said that these people were maybe misguided, uninformed, and or anti-Semitic, which was a real slander. Ironic, because a lot of those protests were led by Jewish people here in the United States.
And Norman, what about people in the U.S. government speaking out against the war? Was there any coverage of that?
There have been a number of people in the U.S. State Department and elsewhere in various agencies who have resigned explicitly in protest, often with very moving letters to the president or the secretary of state saying, I cannot abide remaining in this government while it supports genocide against people in Gaza, when most of the victims, acknowledged to be now over 40,000, and that's an underestimate, being children and women. I cannot stay in this government. I am resigning in protest. And when that has happened, there has been some fleeting coverage. You would have an article in a daily newspaper, such as the New York Times and Washington Post. There might be an interview on CNN or another network, but very briefly. And the essence of a propaganda system is not the brief occasional, the exception. It's the routine. That's the essence of propaganda, and the framework and the assumptions and the overwhelming quantity and type of sources that are being quoted and cited. So unfortunately, even though these have often been very profound moral statements and people sacrificing their own careers in government to protest against this genocide, generally the U.S. news media have given those protests and those acts of conscience very short shrift.
And Norman Solomon, you also claim that the media generally portrays, reports, if you will, the deaths of in Gaza of the Palestinians as quote unquote unintended, that claims by Israel that they were making good faith efforts to minimize civilian deaths, well, they go unchallenged. Talk to us about that.
That's a paradigm that has been just so consistent throughout the so-called U.S. war on terror in the last 23 years. And it has been accentuated, I think, even more egregiously in terms of the line that has come out from Washington and the Israeli government vis-a-vis the war in Gaza. It's really a cop-out, it's an excuse, and it's a standard way of trying to use words to blow away the realities of what these wars have been doing. The fact is, these deaths of civilians are entirely predictable, they are entirely foreseeable, and anybody who is at all conscious in a military hierarchy will know that when you drop these bombs on people in civilian areas, you're going to be killing a lot of children and women and other civilians. And yet the pretense is there. It's unintended. Therefore, it isn't something that we're culpable for, we're responsible for. And I give an analogy in the book of, let's say that some criminals are being chased in a downtown shopping area near where you live, and the police are spraying the front of the stores with machine gun fire and going up and down the street during the middle of the day, just firing willy-nilly at people because they say there are some criminals maybe in some of the stores. Well, the police could always say, oh, look, all these deaths, there are these dead bodies all over town. They're civilians, women and children, but we didn't intend it, so we're off the hook. That is preposterous. And then you add to that the very clear evidence the Israeli government is intentionally killing civilians. There is no doubt about it that this is a concerted effort, including even the use of 2,000-pound bombs in very heavily populated urban areas. This is a goal of the Israeli government. And if any listener is going to say, oh, that sounds anti-Semitic, by the way, I'm Jewish, and I understand what the ideology is operating now in terms of the policies in Israel. Add to that the fact that starvation is being used as a weapon of war by Israel. That has been true beginning in October of 2023. It has been verified by the United Nations, and it's a war crime. And the fact is that the United States has been supporting the Israeli government as it engages in methodical war criminality, including using the denial of food as a weapon of war.
Overall, in sum, perhaps in a sense, you claim that the news media, as well as the U.S. government officials, in broad strokes, have both displayed really a mindset that in some shows that they believe Israeli lives, well, they matter a great deal more than do Palestinian lives. That's what this seems to be all about, doesn't it, Norman?
Well, very much. It's reflected in the way that the news media and those in political power in Washington use language and promote their policies. When the United States, and just in the last couple of months, has green-lighted about $25 billion with a B dollars, more weapons to the Israeli government while it engages in continued mass murder, mostly of civilians, in Gaza, what conclusions are we to draw? We could use an analogy. People may remember the terrible tragedy in Uvalde, Texas, where guns were sold to an unhinged young man who went out and slaughtered people at a school. And there were questions raised afterward. Well, the weapons were bought at a gun shop. How could the gun shop owner sell the weapons to this person? And the response was, well, the gun shop owner didn't know how the weapons were going to be used. In contrast, the president of the United States knew and has known how the weapons were being used and yet continued to send them. And that's where the clarity of the actual motivations and activities of the Israeli government should come into clear focus. This is something that has been dodged by the U.S. media. And I give an example in the book where in February of this year, after coming back from the border of Gaza and Egypt, the border of Gaza and Israel, Senator Van Hollen from Maryland gave a very moving speech on the Senate floor. And he said, the denial of food to starving people is a war crime, and the leaders of the Israeli government are war criminals. He said that point blank. And a few hours later, the same Senator Van Hollen voted to send $14 billion worth more of weapons to leaders he had just called war criminals. And this is the kind of doublethink involved that is so pernicious and makes the U.S. government an accomplice to mass murder and genocide.
This is Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Jim Lafferty. You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. We're interviewing Norman Solomon about his new book. Norman, I wonder, do you perhaps also feel that the news media has gone out of its way to portray the slogans and demands of the pro-Palestinian movement on campuses and elsewhere as being largely and unquestionably anti-Semitic, and that they fail to cover the arguments as to why those slogans and demands are not anti-Semitic?
With very rare exceptions, that is the case. It is a reflex. It has been in place for decades when criticisms have been made of the Israeli government, and it has been greatly accentuated in the last 12 months. And it's really been a scam on a propaganda basis operated by the Israeli government and its supporters in the United States. This is the gist. For decades, Israel has been engaged in ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. It has been periodically killing thousands of civilians in Gaza. It has evicted so many Palestinians from their homes. And yet, whenever the apartheid system, and it is an apartheid system, in Israel gets publicly criticized, it is so often that the criticism is denounced as anti-Semitism. And the technique is, even though Israel is committing all of these crimes on a daily basis, these horrific policies against our fellow human beings, the Palestinians, when those policies are criticized, the Israeli government and its supporters wrap those crimes in the Jewish religion. And it's a basic, very fundamental newspeak, doublethink maneuver that we need to challenge directly.
You know, Norman, I'm wondering, when you think about the bias that you've just demonstrated and pointed out to us, a media monopoly pretty much in this country today, isn't it? Five major corporations owning the main sources of media that people are exposed to and have. It's a capitalist society. So long as that's the case, how realistic is it to think that one can effectively challenge this media bias around Israel and the war in Gaza or around anything else, frankly?
It's a pretty powerful corporate media wall, and yet the wall has cracks in it. And those cracks sometimes become very significant when we think about even the Iraq War, which was cheerled by U.S. corporate media. As protests grew and as people saw through the excuses for U.S. aggression on Iraq, public sentiment really changed. I think it's really dramatic and very telling that even though there has been an ongoing propaganda barrage in favor of Israel, and certainly intensified in the last year, the majority of people in the United States, according to polls, want an arms embargo against Israel. And I think that's quite remarkable. Despite the failure of people on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, whether in Congress or the White House, to actually speak clearly about these terrible atrocities being committed by the U.S.-backed Israeli military on a daily basis, most of the U.S. public, despite the media coverage, doesn't want the weapons to keep going to the Israeli military. And I think that goes to the fact that propaganda has its limits, and independent media outlets, including ones like we're speaking on today, when people take the initiative, they say, we're not going to be defeatist about this, we're realistic, but there are other messages, there are other voices that have to be heard, and that really can make a difference in the long run.
Norman Solomon, in the book, we've been talking about your latest and up-to-date afterward about the invisibility of and the bias of the media with respect to the war in the Middle East, the war in Israel and waging in Gaza and so forth. But the book itself, I think, it makes the point in an overarching way that I'd like you to share with our audience. I mean, talk to us about how the extent of militarism in the United States, the number of military bases we have, the number of conflicts on a daily basis the U.S. military is involved in, either directly or in some kind of advice capacity. Talk to us about any number of aspects of what you write about so brilliantly in the invisibility of war, if you will, and how that ties in what we've been talking about thus far on the show.
Overseas, very few people in this country are aware that there are 750 U.S. military bases, and the impacts at home are rarely talked about. I mean, here we've gone through these horrible hurricanes of late, and the lack of resources to help people prepare and then recover from is just very flagrant. Martin Luther King Jr. talked about not only what he called the madness of militarism, but another phrase he called this military spending demonic, destructive suction tube that is just taking money away from what we need here at home. And that's as true in 2024 as it was when he talked about it in 1967. I think the invisibility of war is so crucial in terms of not only far away, we don't really know what the U.S. is doing, bombing and helping other militaries to engage in their activities, but the invisibility of war at home. And in terms of recent events, when I was earlier this year working on this paperback edition of War Made Invisible, I thought about, well, how does invisibility apply to what has been happening in Gaza? And it's very much the conceit in U.S. media that somehow, if you watch the news, if you read your newspaper, that somehow you know, you see what war is about. And that very conceit accentuates the falsity and the misunderstanding. You know, there's that saying, it's not what people don't know that bothers me, it's what they know that just ain't so. And if we think we know what war is about because this news coverage is telling us, then it's a double whammy because there are inherent limits to what journalism can convey about it's what it's really like to be in a war. War is about death, it's about terror, it's about maiming. And yet, in our news coverage, there's very little of that actually conveyed. And then another part of the invisibility in terms of the war on Gaza is that there's so much ethnic, religious, racial, and nationalistic bias that comes through. We've seen again and again how the Israelis who have suffered from Hamas attacks, they have been really treated with great empathy, as they should be. But it's relatively rare to have a personal kind of bit of coverage in terms of what Palestinian people are going through. And in terms of the title and subtitle of the book, I eventually got a handle on how War Made Invisible applies to what has been going on in Gaza. But then I thought about the subtitle, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. And it became clear to me that the Israeli military is part of the U.S. military machine. There is a separate command structure, but more than ever we've seen since October of 2023 that the so-called Defense Department of the United States and the so-called Israel Defense Force are really operating in an integrated way. And I think that's very important because, again, militarism is so ubiquitous and pervasive in U.S. society at so many levels, politically, economically, psychologically, in terms of media, in terms of adulation of the U.S. military. And that really has bled over and merged into the adulation given to the Israelis as supposedly fighting for a democracy in the Middle East. How can you have democracy when, as B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights group, Amnesty International, and Human Rights Watch have been documenting for years, that Israel is an apartheid state? So how can you have an apartheid state and still call it a democracy? One of the sort of gotcha questions that U.S. news media have been using very much during the war on Gaza is, do you think Israel has a right to exist? And we're all supposed to say yes. And my answer is, did apartheid South Africa have a right to exist? Does apartheid Israel have a right to exist? Or if we're going to have a single standard of human rights, should we not be calling for a country that is truly respectful of all human beings rather than, in practice, as Israel is doing, proceed as though some human beings are expendable?
Norman Solomon, you've written a very important book. People should get this book and read it, War Made Invisible. How can people get the book, and how can people follow your work?
A very easy way is just to go to the web, warmadeinvisible.org, and there'll be a lot of information there about the book. And also, my writing is on my website at normansolomon.com.
Well, Norman, once again, here on Law and Disorder, you've provided us with some information that certainly folks are not hearing on the mainstream media. And we thank you so much for bringing that untold story to all of our listeners.
Thanks a lot.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
A quick reminder, if you want to listen to Law and Disorder's podcast, one way to do that is visit lawanddisorder.org. There you'll see our podcast players now positioned at the bottom of each show's post. And there you can click on the three dots in the right corner of the player to either, download, subscribe, or visit the podcast page. Good. That's great.